I'm Stephen, he's Chris, and this is Mobile Arcade Club, a show where we take a look at games from Apple Arcade each episode and talk about what works, what doesn't, and hopefully let you know if it's something you might want to try. On this episode, Chris can barely tear himself away from Cozy Grove, and I try to avoid dysentery on the Oregon Trail.
Hello and welcome to episode 33 of the Mobile Arcade Club. On this episode, we are covering Cozy Grove by Spry Fox, who are based in Seattle, and The Oregon Trail, which was developed by Gameloft Brisbane. And I think we'll start things off with Cozy Grove. Now, I'll start with this one because I was the one who said that I'd give this a crack. So, Stephen, please do feel free, jump in if you have any questions.
Certainly.
And Cozy Grove. I found this to be a lot like, or rather a bit of a hybrid between Animal Crossing, which has been very popular since New Horizons in 2020 on the Switch, and an indie game that was quite popular last year as well called Spiritfarer, because there's a lot of sort of slice of life elements to Cozy Grove, where it's a little life sim where you play as a spirit guide helping to assist the residents of Cozy Grove, who all happen to be different types of spirit bears. They're very, very cute characters. I'm not entirely sure why they're all types of bears, but looking at Spry Fox's development history, it does look like a common theme in their games does appear to be bears, which, who can blame them? They look very cute and cuddly.
They are just adorable when they're not being terrifying and scary. So in this game, it sounds like they'll always be adorable.
Yeah. I haven't had any of them try to tear my throat out yet, so that's a good sign.
That's good for something called Cozy Grove.
I was about to say it might prove to be a bit of an oxymoron, the Cozy Grove name there. But yeah, so all these characters that inhabit Cozy Grove are all these types of spirit bears who have moved on from sort of the regular plane of existence to that of being a spirit. And there's all these different types of bears. So there's those that take on specific roles, like there's a postmaster who takes care of all the mail, or a shopkeeper who deals in all sorts of wares. And then there are other types of bears who embody types of nature. There's a bear that resembles a seagull, or it's a seagull that resembles a bear. I'm not sure what way around you'd like to say it, but then there's also one who is like a nature spirit bear. So they're a bear, they look like a bear, but they've got tree sort of like leafy elements to them, and they're convinced that they're a tree. So it's, yeah, really, really quirky character design, but it's very, very endearing. I suppose, any game where you're talking to animals is a bit quirky, considering animals don't talk, in the real life, to my knowledge, unless you've had other experiences, Stephen.
I wish I could say I had. It would be delightful to talk to my many and various cats that I've had throughout my life, but alas, they just scream at me when it's dinner time, and that's about it.
Too true. Too true indeed. Whereas with Cozy Grove, not too far removed from screaming at you when it's dinner time. A lot of these bears do have various requests of you. So this is where it taps into some of the elements of Animal Crossing and Spiritfarer that I alluded to earlier, because you're trying to help these bears sort of regain some form of, some spectral form, or so that they regain colour, because when you first come across them, they're sort of this grey or washed out sort of outline of a spectre, whereas once you start sort of building a relationship with them and perform tasks and requests for them, then they achieve like a full coloured version, and their little environment with all of their furniture and objects colours in as well, and adds a splash to the environment around them. But similar to the likes of Animal Crossing, it does sort of run on a real-time system where it does display your phone's inbuilt clock as part of the game, and it's very, very relaxed. So things that you do for the bears often include lots of little fetch quest sort of things. So, you know, can you fetch me several branches so I can, you know, craft it into something useful like a wooden shovel, or how about, you know, I've managed to lose my feathers or my something or other that I'm needing to find. So you need to walk around this little island and try and find these objects. And when you've performed a few different tasks for them, then, you know, you'll get a reward for that, and you'll be able to expand your little campsite and that sort of thing. But there's only a limited amount of things that they'll get you to do on any given day. The game, very similar, we were saying just prior to recording, that Cozy Grove bears, no pun intended, some similarity. Your face just dropping there, Stephen. I'm sorry.
I'll give you that one. That was okay.
It does have some similarity with a previous Apple Arcade game we checked out, which was a Game of Thrones, The Tale of Crows, if I'm getting the subtitle correctly. Feel free to correct us on social media or whatever, because that game actively encouraged you, once you'd finish whatever tasks you had on at that given moment, to check back in later. It would actually say, log off, come back later, nothing else to do, which is probably something that a lot of social media platforms could be well served by doing as well.
God, telling us to log off. Imagine if Twitter had just like a, you've spent enough time, log off, get offline, please. That, I don't think they'd do it, but goodness, maybe my life would be improved.
There's probably a third-party plugin that does it, and I think I need it. But yeah, Cozy Grove, there will be moments where you fulfill tasks for these spirit bears and their respective likenesses or nature affinities, and it will say that they're occupied, they're busy, check back in tomorrow and do some more things for them, and, you know, further build your friendship with them, and, you know, do more tasks, and you know, feeding that cycle and scratching that itch that is very much Animal Crossing in nature. You know, you're seeing slow and gradual progress over a longer period of time. So, which I think's quite lovely. It's something that you can dip into for 15, 20 minutes at a time, do various tasks, and, you know, enjoy all the cute ambience, and, you know, then get on with your day or get on with playing something else afterwards.
Yeah, it's really quite interesting that it hadn't quite dawned on me before, but the way you're describing it kind of, it sounds like it almost recontextualizes or rethinks a lot of old mobile games. Gosh, I say old, but I'm talking like early iPhone, you know, ancient days of 2008. But I remember playing a lot of games and they were experimenting with how to keep people engaged. And a lot of the time it would be, you would hit a particular moment and you'd need to wait time in real, you know, real time for something to complete. You could usually pay to make that go past, and it was a bit of a monetization technique, but it sort of kept you coming back into it little by little as you go. But I think this kind of takes that same idea, but contextualizes it in a totally different way, in that you know, people only, or bears in this case, only have so much that they will ask you to do. And it, instead of feeling like it's holding you back from progressing, it just feels like, okay, I'm done, and that's all I need to do for the moment. And just somehow that recontextualization of giving you things to do later and making you wait for things, it just sort of feels like an interesting exploration of that idea. And I like how you mention that it gives you a sort of long-term relationship with the place and potentially with the characters, rather than, you know, just binging through it either by, you know, paying to get past any time blockers, or, you know, with traditional video games, you just sit down beginning to end, you play through the story or whatever, and you're done. It was a great 6 hours and you're done. This way, in a similar way to Animal Crossing, I think will let you build a relationship with the place that you're in, with the characters that are in it, and have those feel like a longer term, like, friend relationship. It's almost, you know, you talk about parasocial relationships with people on social media. What's the description for when I have a relationship with, like, my beautiful Animal Crossing villagers? Like, these, I build up over such a long period of time, it feels like you get to know the place and the people. And it just, it's something that is, it's always been in games, but it's something that has been more pronounced in recent years, or you know, even in longer than that, because Animal Crossing's been around for a while. But it's just really nice having that longer term, the expectation that this game is not a you start it, you finish it, but it's also not designed to funnel money out of you like a lot of, say, service games might be. It gives you the benefits of that long-term relationship without being, without it being having ulterior motives underneath it. It just all feels very, very wholesome, I think.
So would you say then with Cozy Grove, as opposed to having a parasocial relationship, you have a bear-a-social relationship?
Yes. Yes, Chris, I would say that.
the contempt dripping from the voice there. But I think that's one of the things that Apple Arcade is all about in terms of, you know, trying to eliminate predatory monetization techniques. And I know most of our listenership is in the US, so for their benefit, we recently had on our being the Australian national broadcaster, had a pretty lengthy report on monetization techniques in video games, which did spend a lot of time looking at loot boxes and mobile games and that sort of thing. So that's, you know, that's certainly one of the positives of Apple Arcade, is that it completely strips away the potential for that to occur in the first place. So, you know, it promotes ethical game design, I suppose. Mm. One of the concerns on the flip side of that, and no one really knows but the developers what the specific terms of the Apple Arcade contracts are from game to game. And I imagine they would vary from game to game, publisher to publisher, developer to developer. But I know there's, you know, speculation that part of, you know, what Apple Arcade requires of devs, or, you know, sort of the funding, or, you know, whatever kickbacks there are, some of it does depend on time spent in game. So of course, as a developer, you're wanting to try and get people to play your game as long as possible, so that, you know, the big people at Apple are like, oh, lots of people are playing this, yes, we'll extend their contract, or we'll give them more of a commission, or, you know, that sort of thing. So that's, you know, if that is, you know, the only measure by which a game is deemed worthwhile, then that is concerning, because there are so many games that are benefited by being a shorter length, or being having a discrete beginning and end, like, you know, so many of the narrative games we've covered, like Tangle Tower, Neo Cab, those sort of things. Whereas something like Game of Thrones, Tale of Crows, and Cozy Grove, you can tell by playing them, okay, this isn't just trying to game or manipulate the system so that, you know, it's just trying to, you know, look good in the eyes of the Apple Arcade folks. It does genuinely use its elongated time, or rather short bursts of time over a longer period, quite effectively, and does it in a way that feels justified. And, you know, rewards you for checking back in, because, you know, in Cozy Grove, you come across new bear spirits. You come across new characters after, you know, performing X amount of tasks, and by upgrading your campsite, or by feeding your mysterious talking campfire spirit wood to...
I see.
Yes. It all sounds very... what's the word? Miyazaki sort of stuff, or Studio Ghibli. And that's, you know, part of Cozy Grove's charm. And it is packed with charm everywhere, from the beautiful watercolor style visuals that really pop when you see the colors come through from the bears and their environment against the previously monochrome environments that they were. Then there's, you know, this relaxing sort of sea shanty nautical soundtrack that plays. It's just really nice and chill, and the characters are very cute and have all sorts of witticisms as well. And I believe at least one of the writers for Cozy Grove, I think, had also worked on Guildlings, which is that we covered a while back. Mm. And I think I can see some of that shared DNA as well, because one of the references that did surprise me and got a good chuckle out of me in Cozy Grove was one of the characters, or several of the characters, when you go through some of their sort of little conversation lines, they make reference to the importance of having friends, because how else will you crowdfund medical procedures in a late capitalist society?
Oof, ouch. That, it sounds so carefree and wholesome, and now that's blown that out the window a little bit.
And it is presented in such a, you know, endearing and carefree sort of way, and sort of, you know, very matter of fact. but yeah, that is a little bit too real, I think, perhaps more so for our friends in the US than here in Australia. But I think there's certainly elements of it that we can all relate to.
Indeed. It really sounds like this, I guess, by the name, it fits straight into the... I hadn't realized that there was a colloquially named genre for this kind of game until very recently, but the sort of cozy game genre, which, you know, by the name, it fits right in, but, you know, encompassing things like Harvest Moon, Animal Crossing, Stardew Valley, all of these kinds of games that have become quite popular recently just because sometimes it's nice to have a pleasant escape from the world that we live in that's not necessarily demanding action-packed action and massive storylines. It's just sometimes nice to spend time in a place for a while that is just a pleasant place to exist in. And it sounds like this fits right into that kind of game.
Or in your case, avoiding a tall giant vampire lady.
Indeed. Yes, we have been talking a little about Resident Evil 8. Definitely on the other end of the spectrum, away from cozy game, I must say.
Indeed. Well, there's been another game that you've played mostly, but I played a little bit of this as well, and it's the other game that I introduced at the start of the show, the Oregon Trail, with this particular version. I say this particular version because, Stephen, I'm sure you'll elaborate shortly. This particular version of the Oregon Trail was from Gameloft Brisbane, which we found very curious because this is a game so deeply set in American culture and Americana that it's very interesting to see an Australian studio work on that and work with it.
Yeah, I thought the same too, because exactly as you said, it's so quintessentially American. I think of the Oregon Trail as a, you know, it's this historical, I guess they take some liberties with history, but, you know, it's a historical educational sort of story of early events in American history. And to have a version of that game made by an Australian developer, they have done a great job, not to say anything, you know, about that, but it just took me by surprise, I must say. So in case anybody doesn't know what this game is, which I really only knew about it from people seem to talk about it a lot, especially in Apple communities, because it was big in like the Apple II when people were growing up, and in other sort of retro gaming communities, it seems to be a fairly common edutainment game that a lot of people grew up with playing in school. But it's a game where you play as a group of travelers who start from Independence in Missouri and travel all the way to Oregon City in Oregon to settle in the West. A trip of roughly 2,000 miles, or I looked it up, 3,200 kilometers for us metric types. And yeah, it's...
Oh, good.
I didn't realize how long ago this game was originally released, but the first version was back in 1971 and developed on, I didn't quite note down the machine, but sort of a time-shared mainframe sort of machine, like predating any sort of Apple II or anything like that. So this thing's had quite a life. And yeah, essentially it's a game where you play as that group of travelers making decisions to hopefully try to make your way to Oregon or die trying, basically. And it's quite a grueling trip. There's so much that comes up along the way that making it all the way to the end is... I would not expect to do it the first time through, let's put it that way.
Yeah, it's brutal, and it establishes so, you know, with the, you know, nice little tutorial that they put you through at the start before, you know, letting off the leash, so to speak, and, you know, trying to do the trail for real. But there's something very, very cool even before that, which I'll let you touch on that, Stephen.
Yeah, well, I think this comes up almost before you play anything at all, and it sort of acknowledges the fact that previous versions of the game didn't necessarily portray the Indigenous peoples of America in potentially the best light, and I found it quite brave and courageous that it specifically says that, you know, for Indigenous people of America, the story that's portrayed here was not a journey, it was an invasion. And the use of that word invasion really invokes some thoughts of things happening closer to home, or that have happened closer to home with our Indigenous peoples. But I found that really, really quite good that they have acknowledged the potentially problematic, such an overused word, but like it acknowledged the fact that the story that was portrayed in the game previously was not all-encompassing of all the people that were involved and affected. And it specifically mentions that they have added Native American playable characters to the game and also collaborated with people in the community so that they are portrayed in a, you know, realistic and, you know, and respectful way in the game, which I found it was just such a really nice touch. I didn't expect this, and it makes me feel great about how they've tackled this game and what could have perpetuated a potentially concerning stereotype or the storyline that doesn't really take everyone's perspectives into account. But they went to the effort to not do that, and I think that's worth applauding.
Yeah, absolutely. I really can't add too much more to that, because, you know, it's to be applauded. It's to be celebrated. And I think it's a practice that absolutely should be embraced and continued by the wider development community. And you see it even in the film and television industry, because I think it's possibly Warner Brothers or... Warner Brothers. That's because they're the ones who do Looney Tunes, and some of those early cartoons had some, you know, especially by today's standards, some pretty horrendous caricatures of, you know, people of color and people of different races, and, you know, now they put up a disclaimer before, you know, those episodes on, you know, whatever corresponding platforms that they're available to view now, that, you know, hey, these are harmful portrayals and stereotypes that we perpetuated at the time, and we recognise that, and you know we'd like to think that we've moved on from that, but in, you know, in the I suppose in the name of, you know, keeping it sort of intact as sort of like a historical artifact of what, you know, what was made at the time, you know, we're keeping it as is, which, you know, is a little bit different to what the case is here with the Oregon Trail, mm-hmm. which I think, you know, they've got a bit more flexibility with a game, because, you know, they're making a more modern version of an older game and are therefore, you know, have a greater capacity to make alterations to that, as opposed to, you know, if you were to, you know, reanimate a cartoon, then I think, you know, perhaps something would be lost in the process. Whereas, you know, because it's a completely new version of a game, they've done this here with, you know, greater respect and representation given to those who were not afforded the opportunity at the time.
Exactly, yeah, and it's good in that it's not a replacement for the previous version, so it's not stopping the old ones being available or anything. This is a new version that has these changes, and this is what is, you know, available now. But yeah, as you say, it doesn't erase the past or anything like that, but it does acknowledge, hey, we know what was potentially a problem with the previous ones, and here's what we've done to improve that. But yeah, as far as the actual how the game goes, the gameplay here involves, you start off with choosing your party, and so you'll need to decide a group of four people who will have their own various skills, personalities, personal backgrounds, equipments and things like that. And it's quite important. You don't realize at the start how important the makeup of your party may end up being as you travel the trail. But you choose your four people as best you can, and you get a certain allotment of money to begin with to buy your wagon, to buy all of your supplies to get you through this massive, grueling trip, and then set off to find your fortune in the West. From there it's quite good. The game plays, it's one that you can play at your own pace. The game, you will set off from a location, you can choose often which direction you go in, and sometimes it'll say if you go this direction you might find a hunting ground or a campsite to rest at, or people celebrating or something like that. So you initially make the decision of where you're heading to, and then along the trail you'll often come up with these seemingly random events along the way, which can be as diverse as you find a stranded couple who need some grease for their wagon. Do you want to give it to them? Do you want to make them pay you money or food for it? And the way that you choose to deal with that can have positive, negative, or unknown consequences. It's hard to tell, because sometimes you won't know the immediate consequence beyond this person being extremely thankful that you've probably saved their life on the trail. It may come up down the road, it may not, but you sort of just have to make the decision at the time and see what happens later on. There'll be all these other random events, like you can find food along the way, you might find a dead animal and decide, do you want to eat this? It's not really roadkill, but you didn't hunt this animal, it's been sitting here dead for however long it has. How safe do you think it's going to be? Do you have someone who's skilled at butchering an animal to get safe food from it? There's just all of these little micro decisions that you need to make as you play. But it's a game that lets you make those decisions at your own pace. So it sort of plays itself while you're moving between areas. And then when you hit a decision, the game doesn't put a timer or any pressure on you to make the decision right now. It's very respectful, or very it lets you play it at your own pace, so you can I found a lot of the time I just sort of set it to play and then look down every now and then, oh okay cool, I've run into a bison, what do I want to do now, and then make the decision then, sort of see what happens, and then just let it go for a little while longer. It's good in that way, as almost like a backgroundy kind of game, I found.
Yeah, it is, but it's still one that you can get a lot out of, by playing it in a more active manner and actively, watching sort of the miles tick down, or watching your characters move across the screen, because the art department has done a wonderful job of, generating these lovely environments, sometimes harsh environments, but sometimes really lush and really beautiful places as well along the trail. A lot of the characters have these, cute little animations as well. It feels very retro game inspired, the way that the characters are animated and the way that they sort of jump up in glee when they pass a skill check or something like that, or, they glow green or they sort of flash red when they fail something. And it's interesting, Stephen, when you alluded to how important it is to get your party composition right, because you don't necessarily know how skilled each of the potential party members is in any given area. You actually have to find that out along the way, because a lot of the different skills, which I wish I took a note of because they've completely escaped my mind, but, things like, hunting prowess or
wayfinding other things like that.
Yeah. So, ability to hunt animals and, get more game or more meat out of them, ability to find their direction, or ability to sense whether the mushrooms by the side of the road are dangerous or not.
Very important, that one.
Yes. A lot of these stats, they're not blank. They all have question marks on them. And when you do come to some of these decision points, these branching points, it will say, okay, which of your party members would you like to send on this particular errand? Or who should try and treat this wound? Or who should hunt this this deer or something like that? Which then, puts you in a little mini game where you're, almost like a twin stick shooter thing, hunt some deer. You don't know how skilled someone will be in any given area until the first time you put them to work in an area. So you may get someone to test, or rather try and observe, the mushrooms and see if they know what type they are and whether they're poisonous or not. And if someone's got a high enough skill in that particular area, they'll be able to identify and say, oh yeah, these are such and such mushrooms. Yeah, they're safe for cooking. Yeah, yeah, used to have these a lot. Or they'll say, oh no, nah, hang on, these are poisonous. We shouldn't touch these at all. Or if they've got a low skill, then it'll just be sort of a waste of your, well, not a waste, but it will be a less productive use of your decision, because they'll look at it and be like,
I don't know.
Yeah. And then, you know, you can't get someone else to check it. But at least for next time, you've revealed what level of skill that character has in that particular field, so you know next time not to send them foraging for mushrooms.
Mm.
Which is very, very cool. There's a lot of sub layers and a lot of meta levels to the game. And another one that's very crucial is inventory management.
Oh, goodness,
with your wagon, because all the items that you accumulate along the way, whether it be your food stash or whether it be your repair tools or medical supplies, that sort of thing, they all take up a different amount of space and are shaped differently, which you almost have to Tetris them into your wagon to make sure they all fit. But if something happens to your wagon, whether by regular wear and tear or whether an event like the time I accidentally tried to cross the river when I didn't mean to, the current was a bit too fast, it took on a lot of damage and damaged my goods. And it then meant a lot of the little squares of the wagon inventory grid were unavailable for me to use, so I then had to toss out half of my inventory because I couldn't fit it all in. So there's several different layers that you've really got to be aware of, and it's tough and it's grueling, and deliberately so, because not that I've done it myself, but apparently the Oregon Trail was quite the journey.
I really quite like how it forces you to be very adaptable to a situation. Like you said, you don't know necessarily the skills people are going to have until you've really put them to the test, and you might think you need some wagon repair things, but they take up so much space. It's like, oh, do I really need it? And you don't know if you really need it. You might make it between different forts or areas without a problem. You might run over a particularly horrible part of road that's been, you know, had ruts dug into it or something like that, and causes damage. And just sort of weighing up risks and thinking about what can you do to mitigate risks, but you can only do so much, thinking about which ones are more important to be concerned about and dealing with them at the moment they happen, it's a really exciting way to do it, and I think a really interesting way of making you think about how much you can plan and how much you just have to leave up to divine providence a little bit. There's just so much that's totally out of your control. Like, you might have a character just, they were rummaging in the back of the wagon and a gun went off. Now they have a gunshot wound in the leg. What are you going to do about it? Have you mm-hmm. prepared for this event that, you know, probably won't happen on most trips, but if it does, you'll be very glad if you brought some medicine and, you know, have a chance to rest up somewhere and have a doctor or something like that. And yeah, there's so many of these layers that it's almost impossible to know everything early on. I've played for a couple of hours and I feel like I'm still learning new things as I go. There are things like, you know, characters who are religious who benefit more from, you know, religious texts and having other religious people around them, and they might be able to improve the morale of the rest of the team in certain cases. And you know, some characters will be particularly charming and maybe able to get better deals when trading with people at forts and things like that. There's just so many variables that you don't have to be aware of all of them. It's not really a game that you can plan for every opportunity or every eventuality, but being aware of what you are in control of so that you can prepare for what you're not in control of is a really interesting sort of mechanic. And I found that really, really quite engaging, just thinking, oh no, I had a gunshot go off that, if you can't tell, it happened a few times to me. But like that made me acutely aware of what I need the next time it happens. It might never happen, but it just sort of is an interesting way of framing how you plan things, and how, for me, it was an interesting experiment in like, when something happens to me, I am acutely aware of it, so I prepare for it, sometimes at the expense of other things, and the game will maybe, if I'm lucky, not punish me for that, but sometimes it will. It's like, I've got all these medical supplies, but nothing to repair the wagon when it falls apart and all my medical supplies go down a river. It's quite something. It's really good fun to play, but do not expect to have success your first try. I don't think it's a learning experience, a random experience, but a fairly fun one that is good fun to play, regardless of whether you just sit down and play it for a couple of hours straight, which you totally can do, or if you play it like me, I was, you know, dipping into it every now and then during breaks at work, little, you know, lulls in time at home. It's just as fun to play that way as it was to sit with it for an hour straight, I think.
Yeah, I agree. I played the Oregon Trail for probably a couple of hours in a single sitting and thoroughly enjoyed that. And I think you may hear the both of us say, you know, how challenging this game is and how there's a lot of elements and a lot of layers that seem to actively conspire against you and think, oh, well, succeeding is just a matter of luck and, you know, the random number generator, you know, working in your favor. But I think it does so in a way that feels fair from a gameplay sense, because I probably bet that people who attempted the trail and had these things happen to them probably thought it wasn't fair. But, you know, in a way that, you know, if you were attempting a, you know, 2,500-mile trek or whatever, there will be a lot of random chance factors that you can't control. You know, if it starts raining and the trail becomes too slippery to, you know, bring your wagon across, you know, that's something you can't really mitigate against, or you know, can only do so much about. So it's random in a way that isn't random for random's sake or just to make it arbitrarily difficult. It's, you know, it's to do so in a way that, you know, tries to reflect the challenge that the people who actually attempted the Oregon Trail, you know, what they actually encountered. And I think a little bit, you know, sort of one of the more gamified elements of this particular version, and I think it's quite well integrated, is that there are leaderboards and high score components as well, when some daily challenges where you can do just a stretch of the trail or do a portion of the trail under specific circumstances, or you've got to try and hold on to as much of a particular cargo as possible, and that sort of thing. And, you know, it's a cool little thing, and, you know, made me very upset when I realized that somehow during the tutorial or the first section or whatever that I fell like 10 points behind Stephen, and I've got no idea why, and I'm very upset about it.
I'm clearly just better at Oregon trailing than you, I guess.
Clearly.
But yeah, and I think, I don't know that I have much more to say about it, but yeah, it is, as you say, I don't want it to sound like it is unfairly random, just sort of out to get you at every opportunity. It almost goes back to its roots as an edutainment game, as a way to put yourself in the shoes of these people making this huge sort of trek and the trials and tribulations that they would have had to face. And in that way, it's a game about reacting to a changing set of circumstances, more so than it is a game about, it's about getting from one place to another, but it's about all of the things that happen along the way. It's the friends and the journey you made along the way, as they say.
Absolutely, or in some cases, the enemies as well.
Indeed. But yes, I think that might be about all we've got to say as far as the Oregon Trail goes. So should we have a look at what we're going to be playing for the next episode?
Indeed, and hopefully there's no enemies to be made in your game that you're going to check out, Stephen, because I'm very keen to check it out as well, or perhaps there will be a bit of a rivalry as to Who can be the best on the links?
Yes, well, I've decided to have a look at Clap Hands Golf out of Clap Hands in Japan. I didn't know until this evening that that is the developer of the Everybody's Golf games that are fairly prolific across the PlayStation platforms. So I was just looking at this thinking, I like Mario Golf. This might be a fun thing to play on my phone or something. But knowing that it's got this a developer with such a proven record at almost exclusively this kind of game, I'm more than excited to give this one a try.
That makes two of us, and the game that I'm going to check out, and I feel like it's some sort of a crime that I haven't actually played this already, so I figure this is as good an excuse as any. I'm going to play Monument Valley Plus. So I'm going to play the Apple Arcade remaster of, I think, what's considered one of the best App Store games of all time, which is a puzzle game, and it's referred to as A Quest for Forgiveness, which perhaps we might need to play should our Clap Hands Golf rivalry gets too heated.
Just maybe, yes. It might be a good chaser after that heated golf.
As it is wont to do. Anyways, thank you very much for joining us on this episode of Mobile Arcade Club. We look forward to having your company once again for episode 34.
Thanks for listening to the show. We hope you had fun and maybe found something useful. If you did enjoy the show, we'd love it if you told a mobile game loving friend about it or gave us a review in Apple Podcasts. It all helps more people find the show. You can follow the show on Twitter at @MArcadeClub, where we'll talk about games from upcoming episodes, and each of us hosts are happy to chat gaming too. Our handles are in the show notes. Thanks again for listening, and we'll chat again next time.